I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Second Tuesday of the month, Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us to talk about birds and other creatures of the natural world. But where is he? Where is Mark? Mark's not in studio. Mark, you're out there somewhere. Stuck in traffic?
I'm here.
Stuck in traffic.
I'm reporting from the field. Let's say I'm out birding.
Yeah, birding from your car.
Yeah. I can give you the weather and the traffic right now. I mean, I'm really in the thick of it here. And so the traffic report is there's lots of it.
Yes, summer. You have to allow more time. You should know that. But anyway,
and it's raining. So I'll give you the weather.
Yeah,
it's raining. It's raining pretty good out here. Too.
I thought maybe you took a side trip there to kind of find that possible pair of bald eagles that may be nesting in the Harwich Brewster area. What's going on?
Yeah, you'd think it would be easier to find an eagle nest, wouldn't you?
They're tough to find, though, aren't they?
They're surprisingly hard to find. They hide their gigantic nest in like a white pine, like the crown of a white pine, kind of in the thick of the foliage. And so it's surprisingly hard to find. We think of ospreys as kind of the big, obvious raptor nest that we see all the time, and they tend to nest out in the open on those platforms in the marsh or utility poles, and they're really obvious. So it's strange to think of a bald eagle nest, which is even bigger, being hard to find, but they are. They still like to nest in trees for the most part.
And so we've been seeing this pair of bald eagles, but we're not sure that they're nesting. So why do you think they might be?
Well, when you get adult bald eagles still hanging around the Cape in likely-looking habitat in, like, March, really February, March, April, they're still there in May, it's really suggestive that they're nesting. In years past, you could potentially see a bald eagle on the Cape any month of the year. You'd get wintering eagles, at the ponds during the winter months, and then in the summer we would see juvenile eagles. Like in June, it was very typical to see a juvenile eagle, presumably that came from a nest somewhere down south where they fledge much earlier than they would up here, and then they disperse north. And so you would see juvenile bald eagles, kind of ragged looking, maybe hanging, sitting around on a beach or something now and again, or just flying overhead. But in recent years, we're getting adult bald eagles during the breeding season. Mm-hmm. And in places where they could easily be nesting and hiding a nest somewhere, like the Punkhorn woodlands in Brewster, kind of into the Harwich area, there's a lot of conservation area, like big woods and ponds, and also Mashpee Wakeby Pond up the road here in Mashpee and Sandwich. Both sites have had adult eagles at the right time of year. And in the case of the Punkhorn area, there was a pair that actually took over an osprey nest in a pretty conspicuous area 2 years in a row, including this spring, but neither time did it work out. The first time the ospreys came back and sort of kicked them out, but then this year, they sort of gave up. It wasn't clear what happened. You know, we're wondering if maybe there's another nesting site somewhere else. Same thing at Mashpee Wakeby Pond. Good habitat, sightings of adults, but no smoking gun, no clear nest site. There's a nest in Plymouth that I visit a few times a year, and you really have to know where it is to look to find it. I bring a scope, and it's on an island in a big pond, kind of in the wild, the interior of Plymouth. And it's very hard to see that nest unless you know exactly where to look. And the adults, if you see the adults, they can kind of lead you to it. But people should be out there looking right now in these two areas. Although at this point, if they did nest, the young would be out of the nest, sort of out and about.
Mm-hmm. That'd be cool to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that piqued our interest this year is a birder, Doug Lyons, was out on Hinkley Pond in Harwich, and there's a lot of herring in there, a lot of night herons in there eating herring, so there's a lot of fish in there, and he was getting photographs of an adult and a juvenile bald eagle, and the question was, who is this juvenile bald eagle? Did that come from a local nest this year?
Wow.
And I sent the photos to Tom French at Mass Wildlife, who is the eagle expert on the state. He was part of the reintroduction of eagles in the 80s and really knows all the stuff about the eagles. And thinking maybe that this was a juvenile, so of this year, a locally produced juvenile and not one of the wandering birds that could have come from Florida.
Wow, that would be just neat, yeah.
So we need to take a closer look at those photos, and we're getting close. We're getting close to the first modern confirmed nesting record of bald eagles on the Cape, because the last confirmed one was like at the turn of the 20th century in Sandwich, apparently. And I think that was the last nesting pair of bald eagles in the state before they were extirpated back then.
Yeah, and it will happen. It will. I mean, they're here, I mean, it's just a matter of time before it happens.
It's very much a growing population statewide, and the state does a bald eagle survey where they fly helicopters around the dense population areas for eagles, which is the Quabbin Reservoir, the Lakeville, the big reservoirs in Lakeville, Connecticut River, and there's some other places where they nest, and they try to do a full census in late winter, and it grows every year. The population is very much a growing one, and so we're due.
Yeah, they really are majestic birds for sure. I wanted to ask you, we had that rain that was just the other day, that like 3 inches in such a short period of time. It was really coming down, and some roads were closed and all of that. Did that knock nests? I mean, did that impact any of our little birds that are nesting? Probably, right?
Absolutely. Rain is not good for very young nestlings in particular. And so those of us who monitor beach nesting birds, piping plovers, lease terns, that kind of thing, you really worry about when a nest hatches and there's heavy rain, because it causes a lot of mortality. The chicks are born with down on them, some of these shorebirds and seabirds, but they can't really thermoregulate very well for a couple of weeks, and they need to be brooded by the adults. And so these heavy rain events can just kind of soak them, and they can sort of die of exposure. So definitely worry about chicks. And it can happen to songbird chicks as well. And it can even happen to big birds, you know, raptor chicks and that kind of thing. But raptor chicks right now are all either out of the nest or very old, so they're probably okay.
They're okay. So if you had a nest in your yard and it fell out of the bush or the tree or something, is it okay to pick it up and put it back and put the babies back in? Yeah, you can do that.
Yes.
Okay. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And you have a lot of baby birds in your backyard. You're not alone, right? I mean, people are reporting a lot of baby birds.
Yeah, I certainly have a lot in my yard right now. It's kind of fun to watch. This is that time of year, you know, and they're just babies everywhere making their little baby sounds. And sometimes it's kind of mysterious because we're not necessarily familiar with these sounds. And, you know, I'm someone who tries to identify every bird I hear, you know, and I'm not that good with some of the baby bird sounds. Like cat birds, I had to relearn that this year. They make sort of a high-pitched, the fledged young make these begging sounds that don't sound anything like normal cat bird sounds, you know, the kind of mewing cat-like sounds that they make. The young ones make this really high-pitched sound.
I have a cat bird nest, but how I figured it out wasn't from sounds. I noticed the bird poop in my driveway, and I went, well, there's like a lot right here. And I looked up, and there are two cat birds with a nest up in the oak tree that hangs over the driveway.
Oh, very good sleuthing there.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good way to find nests, a good way to find roosting owls and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, look down.
Look to the poop.
All right, so if you have some birds, baby birds in your yard, we'd love to hear from you, see what you're seeing. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you obviously have some little nesting birds, cat birds, but what else? You got anything else in your yard?
Yeah. Song sparrows are very, very common, right? Pretty much everybody has them in their yard. You might know their song. They sing quite a bit, and they're very happy with suburbia. They're very common in backyards. And I noticed a nestling sound, not a nestling sound, a fledgling sound. So a bird that's out of the nest, young bird that has fledged from the nest but is still begging from the adults. And so they make these constant sounds to like, here I am, feed me. Here's my mouth over here. And I'm hearing the sound and I see that it's a fledgling that's being fed by a song sparrow, but it wasn't a song sparrow fledgling. It was much bigger than the song sparrow. And so I immediately knew that it was a brown-headed cowbird chick.
Mm.
And so...
Not good.
Right. And so not good for the song sparrow. And so this is, if people don't know, the brown-headed cowbird is an obligate nest parasite, meaning they lay their eggs in other birds' nests. They can't make their own nest. They don't know how, or they're unwilling to. Maybe they just refuse. I don't know.
And so they let somebody else do the work.
They get somebody else to raise their young. And two of the most common host birds around here are song sparrows and yellow warblers. You often will see, if you're in a wetland, shrubby wetland area where yellow warblers nest, you'll often see a yellow warbler feeding this ungodly big chick that's much bigger than the adult yellow warbler. And so this means that the yellow warbler did not raise any of its own young.
Yeah.
And the same was true of these song sparrows. I watched them for a while. I got some photos. The song sparrow pair was only feeding two different cowbird chicks.
Oh, how terrible.
Which was kind of interesting. But
House sparrow nest? Do they do that? I mean, no. We got plenty of house sparrows.
I know, that'd be great if they started parasitizing house sparrows, but they don't really do cavity nesters very much. And house sparrows tend to nest in cavities, so your bluebirds are safe. Tree swallows, there are birds that they will never parasitize. Oh. They generally go for cup nesters like warblers and sparrows and things like that. There are parts of the country where cowbird parasitism is leading to the decline of endangered birds.
Oh, that's awful.
Like Kirtland's warblers in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, really narrow range of occurrence for that species just in this jack pine area of Michigan. And cowbird parasitism was one of the main factors causing them to be endangered. So they had to control cowbirds in that area.
Wow.
Same thing with black-capped vireos and golden-cheek warblers in Texas and least Bell's vireos in California, all birds that were primarily threatened by cowbird parasitism. And it's because of landscape changes that humans have made that made it easier for cowbirds to move in. Cattle pastures, fragmentation. It's easier for them to get into the kind of edgy areas that habitat fragmentation causes, deep forest they can't really get into, but suburbia they love.
Mm. Yep. Let's talk to Bob, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning. So let me share my question. So I know that we're just at the beginning of the summer season, and we just arrived in Cape Cod for a couple weeks vacation, but I understand that the Arctic birds will be beginning their migration patterns pretty soon. So when can we expect to begin to see some Arctic birds on the Cape?
Well, that's a fine question, Bob from East Ham, if that is your real name. I think I know this, Bob.
Oh, okay.
But that's a very good, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about today. That was not a planted question, but that was one of the things I wanted to talk about. Even though summer has just started, Arctic nesting shorebirds are already thinking, time to get to their wintering areas. And so we're seeing the very beginnings of the southbound Arctic shorebird migration right now. It always starts in the beginning of July, and in the next week or two, it'll really get going. We'll be seeing hundreds of short-billed dowitchers, semi-palmated sandpipers, semi-palmated plovers. Again, these shorebirds that nested on Arctic tundra during the very short Arctic summer up there in June, they're done breeding. The adults have left their fledged young behind, or mostly fledged young behind. They're on their own. All the young shorebirds, they're still up there in the tundra by themselves, and the adults are leaving, coming south, and so we're starting to see them at our good shorebird spots like flats in Chatham and, anywhere you have good marsh flats just flats inside a barrier beach. Good places to see this migration starting. And so we've been seeing the Tern Island in Chatham. It's a place I go pretty regularly to because it's a Mass Audubon property. And we have a really good shorebird migration through there. It's a really good feeding place for some of these. And the dowitchers have started.
Oh, nice.
It's just strange to think about a lot of people beginning their summer and the shorebirds are done.
Yeah.
You know,
they're
done with summer. Some of them are thinking about, you know, South America or wherever it is they're heading.
That's good for us, though, because then we can see them passing through. 866-999-4626 is our number, 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Love to hear what's hopping around in your backyard. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Joan is calling from Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I have two male orioles who have been showing up at my jelly dishes, and they each have two babies.
Oh, very nice. Rubbing it in?
Exciting Sunday when all families showed up at the same time on the same dish.
Yeah, this is...
Finally, one of the fathers took off, and he flew down the deck to the other jelly dish, taking one of the babies with him, and the other poor guy wound up feeding three babies, one of which wasn't his.
But, yeah.
Oh, 2 weeks ago today, my dog and I found a baby chickadee that had almost ready to fledge, but it had scrambled out of the nest and down onto the corner of our street. I took the dog home, got a basket, a little basket, and went back and got the baby and put the basket and the baby up into my neighbor's oak tree, which was pretty near the nest. The nest was somewhere in some white pines on the corner of his lot, and... then I went and I got my neighbor to show him what I had done, and we got back down in time to see one of the parents coming into the basket to feed the baby.
Oh, good.
And Bill kept an eye on the baby the rest of the day out his living room windows, and the baby was doing very well. And the next day, everybody left. They had all moved off to another part of Bill's yard, the ones that were in the nest and the one that was in the basket. And I retrieved the basket several days later and had to do some serious cleaning because the baby left a lot of droppings.
What a good... That was good thinking, Joan, to get the basket. That was very clever.
That was excellent work. That's exactly what you should do. And that has worked for everything from chickadees to ospreys.
Oh, wow.
It was an osprey chick a few years ago that the nest blew down and some enterprising folks thought of bolting a laundry basket up into a tree nearby, and it successfully fledged. The adults were able to continue feeding it. So this is something that can work. It's a general rule for baby birds. If you just get them back somewhere safe where the adults can get at them, the adults will feed them, and it can work great.
Yeah. Joan, thanks for that. Thanks for calling in with your story. Yeah.
Getting back to her oriole thing, Joan lives... pretty much walking distance from my house. And this is about the time of year where if you haven't been getting orioles coming to your jelly feeder, that you will get them. And this is when I got them last year. And so an adult male and a fledgling, the fledglings are wicked loud. If you learn what oriole fledglings sound like, you'll realize that they're all over the place right now.
Oh, wow.
They're just
good to
incessant
know.
Sounds. It's kind of... I'm not going
well,
to try to...
Since you mentioned that, Carl in Acushnet writes, thanks for the grape jelly trick you gave me a while ago. It works, and now I see more of the orioles as they stop by to snack. The other day, right after an oriole stopped by and left my hummingbird feeder that has a perch on it, excuse me, a small... Downy Woodpecker flew to it and seemed to have a handful of sips of the sugar water as he stuck his beak into the holes many times. I guess he was wondering what was so good in there. My butterfly sightings are quite rare, but I finally saw a monarch on some milkweed flowers a few days ago. Lucky there is quite a little milkweed in town. There's an old hay field next to my library with lots of it. I hope to see some more monarchs soon. And he says, hundreds of birds stop by daily to eat suet and seed I provide. That provides me with great company as I work in the yard and garden. The garden is doing very well and finally producing squash and some few early tomatoes. Good for you, Carl. Summer has arrived. Jesus, thanks for your help.
What a wide-ranging report from Carl there.
We love those.
That was great. Oh, yeah.
If you have a report, give us a call at 866-999-4626 or email thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we're talking about people we want to hear their stories about what baby birds or other birds they have in their yard. But we also, you got a picture from somebody who had a great crested flycatcher nesting in a metal owl meant to scare birds away from her garden. So there's some unusual places that birds may decide to nest. We want to hear about those too.
Yeah, no, this cracked me up. It was one of those calls, you know, I get a lot of these calls at work where initially she wasn't sure about what the bird was, and so we're kind of talking through it. And, you know, in the background of this story is this idea that the birds were nesting in an owl meant to scare birds. You know, people do you see the plastic ones, those goofy plastic owls people put up that don't really work. But then this one was this kind of art piece, metal thing with kind of complex, it had some kind of hollow parts that birds could get into. And these great crested flycatchers were like, not only are we not scared, we're going to nest inside this owl. And maybe they thought it would scare away predators. I don't know. Maybe they're really thinking things through more than we give them credit for. But great crested flycatchers, I've gotten reports of them nesting in a mailbox, like an active mailbox of an occupied house. So I guess they weren't getting mail for a few days. And so they're a cavity nester. They're unique among flycatchers. And that they will nest in cavities. So if you have your typical backyard bluebird box is usually a little bit small for them to nest in. There's a slightly larger size, just looks like a bigger bluebird box with a little bigger hole. They will nest in those readily. They're pretty common around here. And they're really entertaining. They're beautiful. They're bright, you know, yellow belly and kind of reddish, rufousy wings and a crest. They have a lot of personality. They're loud. And they're fun to have around, and they're eating insects, so I guess that's good too. But you can get them to nest in your yard if you have the right kind of box. But this owl thing just cracked me up, and she sent some prints. I'm going to figure out if we can get those on the website. I think I'll just take a picture of them, and maybe we can put them on the website.
Jenny can work magic.
This was very old school. She literally mailed me prints.
Oh, mailed you? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It was usually I'm like, you know, text me the photos, but this was like, I'll mail them. They'll be there in a week. And so sure enough, there were these great crested flycatchers nesting in this metal owl. But I'd be curious if people have other interesting birds nesting in weird places stories.
Yeah.
And I think Cornell has been collecting stories. They're looking for weird nest site kind of stories on their Cornell has this Nest Watch website where people can report on nesting birds in their yard, whether it's their bluebird boxes or whatever's nesting in their yard. And they were looking for these crazy stories. Carolina wrens are the classic because they like to be around houses, and they get really comfortable around houses. They don't migrate, so they're around your house year-round, and they like to forage around your foundation for spider eggs and things like that. And then when it comes time to nest, they're very comfortable around your house, so they'll nest in one of the classic things is the top of a propane tank. If you look at, there's a nice, like, there's a little side entrance, and it's got a roof on it. It's a great place.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good, Dan. It's Carolina wren.
Mm-hmm. I love those Carolina wrens. They're so cute.
They're such cool birds. They have a lot of personality, and they're little, but they sound like they have a megaphone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was kind of a soft version, but they can blow
pretty
your eardrums,
song.
Those little
yeah.
birds. And there are stories of them nesting inside houses, Carolina wrens. There was one I was reading about where some people left their bathroom window open without a screen, and the Carolina wrens came in and they nested in a plastic cup in the bathroom that the women kept their scrunchies in.
Oh my goodness.
Their hair scrunchies or something.
That window
like that.
Was open for a while.
The window was open they could build a nest surprisingly quickly. They must have just, you know, left for a couple days and forgot about it. They came back and they just were like, okay. They left the window open. And eventually the baby Carolina wrens fledged onto the bathroom floor.
Oh, my goodness.
And they picked them up and put them outside, and all was well. There's another account of Carolina wrens nesting in a hole in the back of a couch. So these people obviously had some house maintenance issues, right? They had bigger problems than Carolina wrens nesting in their couch.
They might have had some bats, too.
Yeah, right.
With the window open like that. Molly writes, recently while visiting a friend, we saw an odd-looking bird at her sunflower feeder. It looked like a female cardinal, but all of the feathers were missing from the top of her head. There was one small downy feather sticking out on her neck, too. I was wondering if this might have been a side effect of a mating ritual or perhaps from a fight. You want to tell her what was going on?
Fight.
She got a second question, but you want to answer that?
All right. So this was a cardinal.
She said looked like a female cardinal.
Yeah. So this is a classic thing. It's actually pretty common, and I've seen it within the last couple of weeks. Cardinals lose all the feathers on their head. They're still attractive. There's nothing wrong with that. I think they're better looking when that happens, frankly. But that's neither here nor there. But it's been a bit of a mystery in ornithological circles whether this is because of mites or some kind of weird molt pattern. You can find evidence for both things. But for whatever reason, cardinals and blue jays are the two species where this happens. And cardinals have black skin. And so it makes them look kind of strange. You see this bird that looks like a cardinal, but it has no crest and it has a black head.
Like, what the heck is that?
And you can be fooled by that. And somebody emailed me pretty recently and they said, oh, you know, we have this. And they named like an endangered Venezuelan bird. Really, like it's called a red siskin. And I had never even heard of it. And I looked it up, and it's highly endangered, but it was occasionally a cage bird. And it sort of fits this pattern. And eventually it dawned on me. I was like, oh, they saw a male cardinal missing his head feathers, because black head and red body. And I sent them a picture of a cardinal with no feathers on its head, with that black skin. And they were like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's what we saw.
Yeah.
And so they can fool you.
All right. Molly says, also in my yard, we've had great success with grape jelly attracting Baltimore Orioles. It's a good thing that I'm retired so that I'm able to refill the dish three times daily. I recognize the males, females, and juveniles, but there is another little bird that is similar in size and shape to the Orioles that I have not been able to identify. The underbelly chest is brick red, and the head feathers, wings, and upper body are black. I've been wondering about the identity of this bird. Thanks very much. Tough without a picture.
I'm going to have you reread the second half because I was busy coming up with a joke for the first half. So before we forget, this segment of the show is brought to you by the Grape Jelly Producers Association of America. Just a note to our sponsors.
Does it have to be grape? Could it be another jelly? Oh, all right. Grape works, I guess.
Grape. Right, okay. I've tried other stuff. I've tried some old.
She says this other bird that shows up is similar in size and shape to the Orioles, but the underbelly and chest is brick red, and the head feathers, wings, and upper body are black. And she's not been able to identify it.
Brick red is a good description of the color of an orchard oriole. Orchard orioles are a little bit smaller, a little bit more petite than a Baltimore oriole. They're less common. But if you go to our sanctuary in Wellfleet and you just kind of hang out in the butterfly garden just outside the doors to the trails, and we have a jelly feeder there. And if you kind of hang back and watch long enough, you'll see, or even from inside the building, you can see them.
Hmm.
Orchard orioles, male orchard orioles, will come to those feeders. Females come, too. They're a little harder to tell from the Baltimores. The females are more of a yellowy-green than an orangey-yellow, like the Baltimore oriole females are. But the males are this beautiful burnt orange kind of color, same basic pattern as a Baltimore Oriole in terms of where the black is and where the orange is, but just a very different kind of brownish orange.
Right. And if Molly could get a photo, we could tell her for sure.
Get a photo, yeah, like we always say, yeah. Snail mail them if you have to, I mean, whatever.
I have a friend who put up a purple martin house in her backyard in Sandwich. And she's been waiting, thinking, oh, they're going to come. And I think I just got a quick look, and it looked more like a house sparrow going in that house than it did.
No, that's the problem.
Purple martin. So how would she, I mean, and they take a while before they would come and find that house, right? I mean, it could be a couple of years before she sees any.
Yeah, right. So we now have a purple martin colony is a strong word. We only have one nest so far, but we have a gourd rack. And this is what the cool kids are doing now in terms of attracting martins. People might remember the old martin houses just look like a giant kind of apartment complex birdhouse with all kinds of holes in it.
Mm-hmm. That's what she has.
Different compartments. And those can still work. They worked for many years, but the gourds seem to work better success rate, and there are people who are really into this. So we have a gourd rack at the sanctuary. People can see it on the right as they the big field kind of north of the building. And it took a couple years. We got some scouts the first year, but they didn't nest. And then the second year, there was a nest. And then this is the third year. We thought the colony would really grow, but it was very kind of late in getting started. We still haven't seen an adult male, but we do have a nest with a first-year male and a female have four eggs in one of the compartments. And we might have another nest. Well, I'll have to check tomorrow when I'm back there. But yeah, you need patience, and you need a plan for managing the house sparrows. We actually have house sparrows using one of our gourds. And what we do, I don't know if people are going to like this, it's better than what they used to do in the old days, but we basically take the house sparrow eggs out and replace them with fake eggs. House sparrows are not native. They can be very destructive to native birds. They take over nesting sites. They'll kill nestlings and eggs and things like that. So we really don't want them around. And you need to, if you're going to have bird boxes of any kind, you need to think about this and have a plan for what you'll do when the house sparrows come in.
Because if the house sparrows take over, the purple martins are not going to come, right?
Well, they've coexisted the last couple of years at the sanctuary where, because there are so many gourds and so few martins, and so one gourd has a house sparrow nest, and then on the other side, the martins nest, and they've coexisted so far. But if the house sparrows start taking over more of them, the martins are probably less likely to be there. You don't want the house sparrows there.
Right.
And so you can try kind of ripping out the nesting material before they have eggs, but they'll keep coming. And you might need to shut it down and try again another year.
What are these fake eggs that you get?
You just have to make them. It's not like, we had volunteers who make them from modeling clay.
Oh, clay,
I think they paint them to look like house sparrow eggs, and they'll happily keep incubating them throughout the season, and therefore not bothering the other birds. They think they have a nest, and then at the end of the season, they haven't at least produced any more young.
My kids found a baby robin on the ground. It looked much younger than the fluffy branchers we've seen and not very mobile. I told them what you always say, to leave it and that the parents might come feed it. But I wondered, would the adult birds really be able to keep it alive? Would they keep feeding it away from the nest? Of course, they wouldn't be able to get it back into the nest.
Right. If they're really young, then you can bring it to a place like Wild Care. If you put it somewhere and you have the time to kind of watch, and, after a few hours, it's pretty clear the adults aren't feeding it, then, you can take it to a place like Wild Care or Cape Wildlife. And but with older chicks, it's always worth giving it a try. Just give nature a chance. Give the adults another chance at feeding their baby. That's the best possible outcome if that works. These wildlife rehab facilities are sort of flooded with things like
swamped,
this right now.
Yeah.
They don't need more mouths to feed if it's not necessary. And so, give it a try. Do what you can to get that baby back within sight of the adults in case they can still feed it. But when they're really young, if you can't find the nest and get it back in the nest, then it'll probably die if you don't.
Could you try the basket thing that Joan tried, or you'd have to know where the nest is? They wouldn't necessarily find it if you just hung it in a basket on a tree, right?
Well, they might, because they make sounds. The chicks make sounds, and if you can get it pretty close to where the nest site is, lower chance of success the younger they are.
Right.
They really need to be in the nest when they're really young. But, it's worth a try. And then some people just raise them themselves, but it's probably not the best idea. The best thing is to get it to a licensed wildlife rehab place.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, 866-999-4626, or our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we've got a couple of emails here. Let's see. This one says, this is from Richard in Sagamore. We put up a jelly feeder in Sagamore, believing that we would attract orioles. This bird is a regular customer. It's just not visible in this photo. It's about the color of its back. Photo taken in June, sitting at the jelly feeder. I doubt it's an oriole, and it is not an oriole.
Not an oriole.
It's a photo. He sent a photo of a catbird.
Yes, it was a gray catbird. And this is your most likely customer if you put grape jelly out. It's all I get at mine right now. I'm trying to, I was starting to say before when Joan from Harwich was talking about hers, I had an adult male bring a fledgling around, but they haven't found my jelly. They came very close to it, and it was almost like they were looking for it from last year, but it was empty. And I was like, I better get some jelly in there. And the catbirds are happy now that I've refilled it, but the orioles still haven't found it. But catbirds, they love fruit, and so they eat a lot of fruit in late summer. It's one of the reasons they're so common around here is we have a lot of fruiting shrubs and trees, black cherry. Oh, there we go. There's a cat. Familiar backyard sound.
I love the catbirds.
Love catbirds. Related to mockingbirds, they're one of the mimic thrushes, and they will imitate things. Mm-hmm. If you listen to them long enough, you'll hear little sort of garbled snippets of other bird song, but they're not like a mockingbird. Mostly they do original material and don't imitate other birds.
Well, it's funny. I know I've said this before. When my daughter was younger, we had a catbird that she would talk to, and he would talk back to her in the backyard. It was really funny to hear her, and then he'd say, come up with the same song.
Yeah.
All right. Wayne says, this year I have been treated to a pair of bluebirds in two of my boxes. One box is close to my deck, so I sit out each evening and watch the adult bring spiders and bugs to the young and remove excrement. At least that's what I think they're removing. While I watch the show, the chickadees and goldfinches are incredibly active during the evening around the feeders and bird bath with all kinds of airborne acrobatics. This has seemed to increase lately. What's going on with this? Are they late maters?
I too have a lot of chickadees and titmice in particular. I wish I had bluebirds. I don't have them. But they are removing fecal sacs. So birds that nest in cavities, they need a waste management plan, right? You think about that.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, so, things like a chickadee or a titmouse, I mean, they can have seven nestlings packed into one of those little nest boxes. That's what I had at my house. And so think about all the, and they're feeding them constantly. If they don't have a plan for all that waste, they're going to be drowning in it in there. That's a nice thought. But anyway, so the way they've evolved to deal with this is when the nestlings, especially when they're young, it comes out in a little neat little fecal sac. So it's sort of self-contained, and the adults can just grab it in their bill. And if you watch cavity nesting birds, swallows and bluebirds and things like that, chickadees, titmice, they'll fly out of the box with a white thing in their bill. And that's what they're doing.
That's right.
They're taking out the trash.
Yeah. Very observant, Wayne.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, very good. Food comes in and waste comes out. you should be seeing lots of recently fledged chickadees and titmice. Excuse me. And I certainly have roving gangs of those guys right now in my neighborhood. I know seven of the titmice came from my box. And the chickadees came from who knows where. And they're just these big boisterous gangs. Yeah. There we go. That's a titmouse.
So I like their sound, too.
The Nantucket folks are puzzled right now. What is that bird?
They don't like to fly over water.
They don't like Nantucket for whatever reason.
Because they can't get there.
They never managed to catch the ferry. They're sort of like me.
Always running a little late.
But yeah, so if you watch, suddenly you've gone from two to, nine chickadees coming to your feeders, and some of them are sort of clumsy and they sound different. And so those are all this year's young, and they're really charming to watch. They're sort of learning how to be chickadees and dangling off of branches, and they're really curious. They're very smart birds. And they're just checking everything out. And we were going to see if we could get them to eat out of our hands. They were just like, they're right at our deck. Mm. So we're still working on that. But they're just fun to have around. They liven up the yard in midsummer.
Yep. All right. Joe writes, in this last week, I've seen a male downy woodpecker at the hummingbird feeder twice. Is that unusual?
It is, but it comes up a lot. It's unusual, but not unusual. And a lot of different birds that you might not expect have a sweet tooth and will go to a hummingbird feeder. That's a source of water, and it's got a little sweetness to it, so why not? And if anything has the tongue, it's a woodpecker. Hummingbirds are drinking with their tongues, these long tongues they're sticking down in there. And woodpeckers also have really long tongues, so they're better equipped to get a drink from a hummingbird feeder than, say, your average songbird.
Boy, Dan, you're on it this morning.
He is
with
on
the
it.
Sounds, huh? 866-999-4626. What's happening in your backyard? 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joe also sent a photo that I can't seem to open, but he wanted us to see that downy was really at the hummingbird feeder.
Mm, sure. Photographic evidence, always
key. Yeah, always good. Yeah. So you were at the annual Truro 4th of July butterfly count. I'm curious to see what you found or didn't find.
Right. So transitioning to other things with wings that aren't birds. I'm really struggling to talk here. That's good. Good for radio. You know, we talk a lot about different bird counts, the Christmas bird count, and I've talked about breeding bird survey. And so there are all these different citizen science type bird counts. But we also have the same thing in the butterfly world. And they're called kind of like the summer version of a Christmas bird count. They're called the 4th of July butterfly counts. And the organization is the North American Butterfly Association that oversees this and compiles the data. And they're just like the Christmas bird counts. It's a circle. A bunch of volunteers get together on a certain day and comb this circle, you know, 15-mile circle. And this count, which I'm the compiler for, is the Truro count, and it takes place entirely within Truro and Provincetown, so the hinterlands of the Outer Cape there. And it was this past Saturday. We had great weather. And there aren't as many butterflyers out there as there are birders. So while, say, the Cape Cod Christmas bird count or the Truro Christmas bird count, we might have 20 or 30 people helping, or at least 15. This, you know, I had, you know, it was like me, my brother, and two other people.
Oh, wow.
And but, you know, that's all we needed. And we hit our usual spots that we check around. Highland Light is very good, and the Hortons Campground, and some wetlands that normal people wouldn't go into this time of year because you need, you know, knee boots. And there's a lot of mosquitoes in there. Like Hatches Harbor is a good place. Those wild cranberry bogs and kind of blueberry swamps up there hold some good species. And there's a place we go in Provincetown that apparently was a soccer field back in the day. It's called Evans Field. And a friend of mine who grew up in that area, he's like, yeah, we used to play soccer there. And I'm walking around. It's like 18 inches of water. Mm. It's wild cranberry and all, you know, all kinds of other native shrubs. And I'm walking around in knee boots. Like, people played soccer here? And sure enough, the old bleachers are there.
Oh, that's
just
funny.
This kind of relic of Provincetown past. But it's very good habitat for certain butterflies, certain rare things. In that case, is a species called the Appalachian brown, and it only occurs in swampy areas, and that's the only place we get them. And so, like with birding, you're reading the habitat, and you're using your prior knowledge about where things occur. And the thing I like about butterflies is this intimate connection with plants.
Mm-hmm.
And because I like to be a good all-around naturalist, I'm very interested in plants and insects and the way they interact. There's so many fascinating interactions, and butterflies are really intimately connected with plants in a couple of different ways. As you probably know, you know, they take nectar from flowers, and you might see them in your garden drinking from, you know, butterfly weed or milkweed, whatever you have there. Lots of different flowers, but they also lay their eggs on particular plants that their caterpillar larvae then eat. And for some species, they only will lay their eggs on a certain one kind of plant that maybe is not that common. And so that limits their population, makes them rare. And other species will lay their eggs on just about anything and or a lot of different things in the daisy family, for example. And so they'll be common. And so it's just a great way to get out and enjoy the natural world in a different way, kind of a different search image than birding, right?
Yeah.
You're looking down, you're looking at small things, you're looking at patterns and flower distribution, plant distribution, and kind of making predictions like, I'll bet this species will be there. And then sure enough, it is.
Yeah. I planted a whole bunch of milkweed, excuse me. And I'm having the same problem. Is this contagious?
I know. I don't know what's going on.
But I have lots of bees, but very few butterflies. And my yard, I used to have so many different kinds of butterflies, and they would be all over all the time. And now, I have some, but nothing like I used to have.
Yeah, I know. This has been a theme, and I don't know. I mean, it's you want to kind of look at all the spraying that's going on now, and lots of people are spraying
not
their
my
yards
yard,
for,
but probably
no,
around.
I
yeah.
know, but
yeah.
in the general area, somebody
yeah.
is.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure.
You know, my neighbors spray some nasty. They don't know any. They just have a tree company come and spray mm-hmm. some stuff, like whatever. You know, we're spraying the trees for gypsy moths, and you know sometimes that's necessary. But people are spraying some of the more generalist kind of pesticides that kill everything, or they'll kill all caterpillars. And so you wonder what effect that's having, because the spraying has become so widespread with the fear of losing your trees.
Well, also ticks.
But
people
the
are
tick
spraying
thing
for ticks,
is another
yeah.
thing. And, you know, even experts are recommending, you know, spray your yards. And boy,
well, not all experts are recommending that. So they're saying spray your, you know, put the permethrin on your shoes or you know,
right.
the clothing.
Right, that's your first line of defense.
I mean, that's going to stay on there. You spray your yard, it, you know,
yeah.
rains and it's gone.
Right. I mean, we have deer ticks in our yard and they come in. So we our dog now takes the Bravecto or whatever it's called that, you know, mm-hmm. kills the ticks on them. And, you know, we just check ourselves and whatever. I can't imagine just spraying your yard with a generalist insecticide like that. But, you know, people are really paranoid about the ticks. And you mm-hmm. just wonder about what effects that's having on all the other
right.
insects in neighborhoods because it's the spraying is so widespread now.
Yeah. And the monarchs are tough. I mean, that's a whole other issue, too, the monarch butterflies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that it's harder to put your finger on what's happening in the Northeast here. It's often weather-related. In the biggest part of their range, the most important part of their range is the middle of the country, where they migrate up and down through the central part of the country from northwards from Mexico in the spring, and then that final generation in the fall goes from Canada back to Mexico, mm-hmm. like up and down through the middle of the country and through this area as well. And that's where you've got a lot of places that used to have milkweed, native prairie, that had lots of native milkweed is now gigantic row crop fields where the milkweed is either confined to the borders or is gone because of all the Roundup they use, the weed killer. And so there's some, you know, real questions about what's going on with monarchs. There's a lot of concern about it. There's still a lot of questions that haven't been answered in terms of what's going on, but it's something that people are researching and it's something we're concerned about. And there definitely don't seem to be as many here in the Northeast, but it's not mm-hmm. it's not as clear why.
Right. And for those who missed the Truro butterfly count, there is the 4th of July butterfly count happening in Falmouth on Saturday, mm-hmm. July 15th at Crane Wildlife Management Area, which is a great place for butterflies. They have milkweed and butterfly weed and a lot of other things that the butterflies like. And anybody's welcome. They say they're going to be walking on flat dirt roadways mostly, so bring a lunch or a snack, a hat, water, binoculars, and a notepad.
Yeah, yeah. We want to get more people involved in this and get some more butterflies going, so that's a good one. There's a Brewster count, not this coming Saturday, but the one after that. And I cover the sanctuary in Wellfleet, and I cover some sites in East Ham. And then other folks meet at, I think, at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History. You can find information about these counts on the Mass Butterfly Club website. Mm-hmm. Mass Butterfly Club actually has an awesome website with all kinds of information. There's free walks, most of which are off Cape. They don't have a huge presence on the Cape, but these butterfly counts, these 4th of July counts are going on. There's a Barnstable one also the same day as the Brewster one, and I know they need help.
So they're fun.
It's another way to experience a natural world kind of at a micro level, like looking mm-hmm. down in plant-insect interactions. It's cool stuff.
Yeah. And here's something to look into. Jenny says, we've heard of some landscaping companies that offer spraying of plant oils such as rosemary and lavender to get rid of ticks. They spray the whole yard. So there might be some natural things that we can use, and we should look into that, I guess.
Yeah. I've done some reading about that. I think they are mostly not as effective. You have to spray them more often, and even then they're not as effective. But you know, there are other options out there. It's not clear how well they work. Mm-hmm. Best thing is to really check yourself, permethrin on your clothing, that kind of thing.
Yeah. All right. Mark Verity, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday every month to talk birds and other creatures of the natural world. Thanks for being here, Mark. We'll
catch
see you
next time.
Month. Okay. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.